means community in the most comfortable environment possible. The food bank helps to ensure that Queens students can be healthy and productive as they pursue academic achievement and alleviates poverty amongst Queens community members. We are open Monday to Friday from 5:30 to 6:30 p.m. in room 105 of the Rideau building. For entry into the food bank, we ask to see the sticker on the back of your student card to ensure you are a valid student. We have an amazing team of volunteers to welcome you and answer any questions you may have. To donate, you can e-transfer controller at ams.queensu.ca with the subject line AMS Food Bank Donation, or bring non-perishables to our location during the service hours. Also, check out the Pay What You Can Peach Market, providing equal access, changing hunger, in the new medical building for fresh soup and entrees on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. For any questions, please reach out to foodbank@ams.queensu.ca.
This is Democracy Now!
The Trump-aligned majority on the State Board of Election in Georgia is rigging the rules so that local election officials don't have to certify an election if a Democrat wins. That is a crisis for democracy that has the potential for mass chaos, disenfranchisement, and confusion in November.
In the key battleground state of Georgia, Democrats are suing to halt new election rules that could be used to block certification of November election results. We'll speak with voting rights journalist Ari Berman. And we go to Texas, where the Republican Attorney General just led a series of raids on Latinx leaders and members of LULAC, the country's oldest and largest Latino civil rights group, accusing them of voter fraud. LULAC is calling for the DOJ to investigate the Texas Attorney General. But first, the Israeli military launches its biggest operation in the occupied West Bank in close to two decades, with hundreds of troops raiding the northern cities of Jenin and Tulkarem. At least nine Palestinians have been killed. We'll go to Ramallah to speak with Palestinian physician and politician Dr. Mustafa Barghouti. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. At least nine Palestinians were killed overnight as Israel's military carried out its largest raid in the occupied West Bank in two decades. Israeli soldiers, backed by armored vehicles, bulldozers, fighter jets, and drones, launched simultaneous raids on Jenin, Tulkarem, and Tubas. The Palestinian Red Crescent Society reports Jenin's three main hospitals were besieged with Israeli soldiers barring ambulances from transporting the wounded. Other witnesses described Israeli bulldozers destroying roads, water, and power infrastructure. As the raid got underway, Israel's foreign minister, Israel Katz, called for the mass displacement of Palestinians in the West Bank. Katz wrote on social media, quote, "We need to deal with the threat exactly as we deal with terror infrastructure in Gaza, including the temporary evacuation of Palestinian civilians and any other step needed. This is a war for everything, and we must win it," Israel's foreign minister wrote. Palestinian health officials say Israeli raids on the West Bank since October have killed over 650 Palestinians, 148 of them children. After headlines, we'll go to the occupied West Bank, to Ramallah, for the latest. Israeli attacks on the central and southern Gaza Strip have killed dozens of Palestinians over the past day. Among the dead are six people who were killed when an Israeli airstrike tore through residential buildings in the city of Khan Yunis.
A house was bombed, filled with residents. It had about 100 people in it, displaced people who came from Rafah and the cities around Khan Yunis. They were all bombed by F-16s. They were all children and women, all children who have no relation to the resistance or anything else. The Israeli military is committing a genocide.
In another attack, Israeli forces struck a school sheltering displaced people in Deir al-Balah, killing eight Palestinians. And earlier today, forces killed Palestinian photojournalist Mohammed Abderrabo and his sister in an airstrike on their home in the Nusayrat refugee camp. The Palestinian Journalist Syndicate says Israel's killed at least 161 media workers since October 7th. On Tuesday, the United Nations warned Israel's continued assault on Gaza has severely hampered aid efforts and is disrupting plans to launch a mass vaccination campaign against polio next week. Israeli forces in Gaza have rescued a Bedouin Arab Muslim man who'd been kidnapped on October 7th. On Tuesday, Israeli soldiers said they found Qaid Fahan al-Qadi alone underground in a tunnel. He's the eighth hostage to be rescued. In Ukraine, at least six people were killed Tuesday as Russia's military continued a barrage of drone and missile attacks on critical infrastructure. Ukrainian officials have called the recent strikes the largest aerial assault since Russia's invasion in 2022. Among the dead are four people who were buried under the rubble of a hotel flattened by a Russian missile in the city of Kryvyi Rih. On Tuesday, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said he hoped to present President Biden with a plan for victory next month when he visits the United States for the UN General Assembly. Zelensky said he'd also share the proposal with Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump. But Zelensky ruled out any immediate ceasefire with Russia.
There can be no compromises with Putin. Dialogue today is in principle empty and meaningless because he does not want to end the war diplomatically. He does not want it. He pretends to be ready for a diplomatic way, but under the condition of giving him 30% of our land.
The head of the International Atomic Energy Agency is warning of the heightened risk of a nuclear catastrophe after Ukrainian soldiers pressed their counteroffensive deeper into Russia and close to the Kursk nuclear power plant. On Monday, IAEA chief Rafael Grossi said after a tour of the aging nuclear facility that Ukraine and Russia must cease fighting around all nuclear sites, including Kursk and the Russian-occupied Zaporizhzhia power plant in Ukraine. Grossi warned the Soviet-era Kursk nuclear plants' reactors are not protected by the sort of containment domes typically found in modern nuclear facilities, making them especially vulnerable to damage from missiles or artillery fire.
A comparison like this, equating Chernobyl with Kursk, I think is an exaggeration. But this is the same type of reactor and there is no specific protection. And this is very, very important.
In Afghanistan, the Taliban's approved a wide-ranging morality law that forces women to completely cover their bodies and remain silent in public. The law will be enforced by the so-called morality police, who work under the Ministry for the Propagation of Virtue and the Prevention of Vice. The law codifies many rules that have been in place since the Taliban returned to power 3 years ago. The law has been widely condemned. This is Ravina Shamdasani, spokesperson for the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights.
These are partners who are being completely silenced, and they're attempting to render them into shadows. Their voices are no longer permissible. Education is no longer permissible. You cannot even see their faces. This needs to stop, and we need to continue talking about it. We need to continue advocating for it and putting pressure on the authorities to listen.
Afghan women have been defying the Taliban's edicts in videos posted on social media or shared with human rights groups. This is a woman living inside Afghanistan who concealed her identity as she recorded herself singing, "You have silenced my voice until further notice. You have imprisoned me in my home for the crime of being a woman."
زدی تا امر ثانی مهر خاموشی دهانم را محیا میکنی تا امر ثانی آب و نانم را مرا با جرم زن بودن اسیر خانه ام کردی.
In India, protests are continuing over the rape and murder of a young medical student in a Kolkata hospital earlier this month. On Tuesday, police fired water cannons and tear gas as thousands marched in Kolkata to demand the resignation of West Bengal's chief minister. In news from Washington, D.C., Special Counsel Jack Smith has filed a revised indictment against Donald Trump for his efforts to overturn the 2020 presidential election. Trump faces the same criminal charges in the case, but Smith reworked parts of the original indictment after the Supreme Court granted Trump broad immunity for official acts he took as president. The case is not expected to go to trial before the November election. In campaign news, Donald Trump's added two former Democrats to his transition team, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and former Hawaii Congressmember Tulsi Gabbard. Kennedy suspended his independent presidential campaign this weekend, but his name will likely remain on the ballot in some states. Kennedy's reportedly aiming to become Secretary of Health and Human Services if Trump is elected. Kennedy, who was once a prominent environmental lawyer, is a leading figure in the anti-vaccine movement. He has endorsed Trump despite once calling him a, quote, terrible president. And in Mexico, President Andrés Manuel López Obrador has paused relations with the U.S. and Canadian embassies after the two countries criticized Mexico's efforts to reform its judiciary system. Part of the reform calls for judges to be elected by popular vote. Mexico's president-elect, Claudia Sheinbaum, who will take office October 1st, defended the proposed changes.
¿Qué es mejor?
What's best? Justices of the Supreme Court elected by the Senate of the Republic or by the people of Mexico? Who says the people of Mexico? Raise your hand. This is democracy. Democracy to elect the president, democracy for lawmakers, and democracy for the judiciary too, so that it is a judiciary at the service of the people.
Last week, U.S. Ambassador Ken Salazar criticized Mexico's judicial reform proposal, saying, quote, popular direct election of judges is a major risk to the functioning of Mexico's democracy. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
At least 9 Palestinians have been killed and 11 injured as the Israeli military launches its biggest operation in the occupied West Bank in close to 2 decades. With hundreds of troops backed by armored vehicles, bulldozers, fighter jets and drones launching simultaneous raids on the northern cities of Jenin and Tulkarem. In Jenin, Israeli forces have surrounded the city, blocking exit and entry points and access to hospitals and ripping up infrastructure in the Jenin refugee camp. Israeli forces have also been closing down the main roads leading to Tulkarem and other cities. An Israeli military spokesman told a news conference the raids were the first stage of an even larger operation in the West Bank. As the raids got underway, Israel's foreign minister, Israel Katz, called for the mass displacement of Palestinians in the West Bank. He wrote on social media, quote, "We need to deal with the threat exactly as we deal with terror infrastructure in Gaza, including the temporary evacuation of Palestinian civilians and any other step needed. This is a war for everything, and we must win it," he said. Over 650 Palestinians have been killed in the occupied West Bank since October, nearly 150 of them children, most of them during near daily raids by the Israeli military. For more, we go to Ramallah in the occupied West Bank, where we're joined by the Palestinian physician, activist and politician, Dr. Mustafa Barghouti. He serves as general secretary of the Palestinian National Initiative. Dr. Barghouti, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you explain what's happening in the occupied West Bank?
Well, Amy, thank you for having me. But what's happening is absolutely horrifying, because what we see here is Israel trying to transfer the genocide war that is conducted in Gaza and the war of ethnic cleansing from Gaza to the West Bank. And what we see here is a unilateral war from the side of a huge Israeli army, which has airplanes, which has tanks, which has huge number of soldiers against basically civilian Palestinian population. You have to understand that the West Bank is an area that has been under Israeli military occupation continuously since 1967. So it's an occupied territory. And now the Israeli army, which is occupying us all this time, is conducting a war on occupied people. It's the worst and gravest possible violation of international law that governs the behavior of an occupying power. And their goal is very clear. It's, as Israeli Minister of Foreign Affairs said, it's ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. This is a fascist Israeli government governed by fascists like Netanyahu, Smotrich, and Ben-Gvir, whose goal and aim is to annex the West Bank, is to settle Israeli illegal settlers in Palestinian territory and displace the Palestinian population. They are trying to repeat the Nakba. They are trying to repeat the ethnic cleansing that took place in 1948. And this time, the Israeli army is invading not only Jenin and Tul Karim and Nur Shams camp and Tubas and Far'a camp, they are invading in so many areas in the West Bank. So many villages tonight were attacked and continue to be attacked. Hundreds of people have been arrested in this campaign. And the worst thing is that the Israeli army and bulldozers are destroying the infrastructure in many refugee camps, especially Nur Shams camp and Jenin camp. They are destroying roads. They are destroying power infrastructure. They are destroying water pipelines. They are destroying homes. And there is no limit to what they are doing. And at the same time, the world is watching and doing nothing. It's an absolute, absolute, unacceptable, horrible war crime that the Israeli army is conducting once again inside the West Bank. And I repeat, they are trying to repeat the same ethnic cleansing, the same genocide that is committed in Gaza, where, by the way, the war crimes continue. And every day we are, the Israeli army is killing 40 or 50 Palestinians. Most of them, of course, are civilians.
And Dr. Barghouti, I'm wondering your sense of whether this extreme right-wing government in Israel is determined to keep the fighting going, even in the face of a huge international criticism, not only with the assassinations and the attacks in Iran and in Lebanon and Gaza, but now in the West Bank. Is it your sense that they feel this is their opportunity to finally have a decisive cleansing of the Palestinian people?
Absolutely. I think that's what they are trying to do. This is a fascist government run by theo-fascist people who have no respect of any human right, no respect of any international law. And their goal is ethnic cleansing, yes. Their goal is annexation of the West Bank. And what's happening now in the West Bank proves that the Israeli attack on Palestinians is not because of Hamas, because Hamas is not governing in the West Bank. It's the Palestinian Authority, which was stripped from all its authorities. And it's not about 7th of October, because these same acts started to happen before the 7th of October. And that shows you that the 7th of October was a result rather than a cause of what's happening. And now the Israeli ministers are coming out claiming they are fighting Iran in the West Bank. What kind of lie this is? The people who are occupied by Israel since 57 years are Palestinians, not Iranians. The people who were displaced by Israel in 1948, 70% of the Palestinian population became refugees because Israel displaced them through massacres. They were Palestinians, not Iranians. But as usual, Israel is trying to claim that it is fighting some kind of another country. Before it was the Soviet Union, then it was Egypt, then it was Syria, then it was Iraq. Now they're talking about Iran because they don't want to admit that the real struggle here is the struggle of the Palestinian people for freedom, to end occupation, to end the system of apartheid. They are trying to cover up the reality. And the reality is that there is an occupier, which is Israel, and occupied people who are Palestinians. There is an oppressor, which is Israel, and its parties, and its government, and its society, actually. And there is an oppressed, which are the Palestinian population. And now, not only they are occupying us and practicing apartheid against us and stealing our land and imprisoning our children, more than that, they are conducting war on us and trying to conduct ethnic cleansing one more time against the Palestinian population. They would not have dared to do all of that if it wasn't for the United States of America, if it wasn't for the unlimited military support that the United States is providing to Israel. They would not have dared to do so if it wasn't for Germany, which is providing them also with military equipment. If it wasn't for so many European countries, and I don't want to put everybody in the same basket, but if it wasn't for all this European support to Israel, while, and if it wasn't for the double standard that is used internationally against the Palestinian population. I would also add, Israel would not have dared to go so far if it wasn't for the silence and the weak reaction from so many Arab governments and Muslim governments.
Yes, I wanted to ask you about that, the Arab and Muslim governments, the role that they are playing right now, and what could they be doing?
Well, it seems they don't have a free will, most of them. Again, I don't like to put everybody in the same basket. There are differences here. But the least they can do is boycott Israel. Declare sanctions on Israel. Cut all the normalization agreements with Israel. That's the minimal thing they can do. We're not asking them to send armies to fight Israel, but at least impose sanctions on Israel. And I say that the world community itself is responsible if it does not immediately engage in boycott, divestment, sanctions against this terrible fascist regime in Israel that is driving the whole region into a catastrophe, and that continues this terrible crime against the Palestinian people. How long can we continue to tolerate this terrible oppression? We've been subjected to ethnic cleansing, to occupation, to apartheid, to oppression, to persecution for 76 years. Why should we tolerate that? And why we don't have the right to struggle for our freedom and for our independence and for our dignity, like everybody else in this world?
Dr. Barghouti, can you talk about the timing of this? You even have the Israeli generals putting pressure on Netanyahu, the prime minister, to sign off on a ceasefire. He hasn't done that, has added more conditions to it. The whole issue of what's happening in Gaza right now, and then shifting to or adding the West Bank, and not that they haven't been attacking the West Bank before.
You know, Amy, what is really shocking is that everything that is happening was not a secret. Everything that we see today in the West Bank and what we see in Gaza was declared as a plan by Israeli ministers continuously and repeatedly. They didn't even try to hide their intentions, and they're declaring it every day, including the intention of annexing the West Bank, including the intention of ethnically cleansed Palestinians. They're not hiding that. And I don't buy that there are differences really anymore between the security apparatus and the army and Netanyahu. If they really had these differences, they would force him to stop. But I think what you see here is a very dangerous phenomenon. It's not just that we have an Israeli fascist government. We also have a fascist society. I've never seen anything like that in previous history, except maybe the rise of Nazis in Germany, where a huge number of the people, out of fear, out of misleading information, out of extreme Zionist ideology, are behaving as fascists. And the reality is that Netanyahu, each time he declares that he's continuing the war, he's getting better votes in the polls. And that encourages him to continue. And that's what pushed him to take this terrible step of moving the war, of continuing the war in Gaza, and then moving it to the West Bank.
And Israel Katz, the foreign minister of Israel, saying this is a war on everything?
Yeah, he means war on every Palestinian, war on every Palestinian child. Out of the 11 people they've just killed in Jenin and Tul Karim, many are children. And two were children in Rafah refugee camp. It's a war on all Palestinians. It's a war of a settler colonial system that wants to erase the Palestinian population. to erase the Palestinian people in the 21st century. That is the meaning of what he says. A war on everything. Because they mean that they want to ethnically cleanse the whole of the West Bank, the whole of East Jerusalem, and to annex them to Israel. And that's why we are attacked not only by the Israeli army, but also by Israeli illegal settlers who are behaving like gangs, reminding us of the same gangs, the Zionist gangs of Shtern and Haganah, that committed more than 52 massacres in 1948, and that erased to the ground 520 Palestinian communities in what became called Israel later. It's a continuation of this terrible war of ethnic cleansing. That is the reality. And this is happening in front of the whole world. It's happening in front of the American government, which does nothing to stop this terrible atrocity and does nothing to stop this terrible ethnic cleansing. On the contrary, they continue to provide Israel with weapons, continue to provide Israel with bombs, and continue to protect Israel in the United Nations Security Council and in every other political venue.
Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, we thank you for being with us. Palestinian physician and politician who serves as General Secretary of the Palestinian National Initiative, speaking to us from the occupied West Bank, from Ramallah. Coming up, Democrats are suing to halt new Trump-backed election rules that could be used to block certification of the November election. We'll speak with voting rights journalist Ari Berman and with the CEO of LULAC, the oldest Latino civil rights organization in this country, which is asking the Department of Justice to investigate the Republican Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton for raiding the homes of LULAC members, accusing them of vote harvesting and more. Stay with us. Trio Gibran. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. War, peace, and the presidency. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We look now at how voting rules in key battleground states could impact the November election results, especially in Georgia, where the laws are Republican-led and backed by former President Trump, who is now running for re-election. This week, the Democratic National Committee and the Georgia Democratic Party sued to halt Georgia's new election rules, which they say could be used to block certification of election results if Democrats win in November. The new rules passed by the Georgia State Election Board allow election officials to conduct a, quote, reasonable inquiry before certifying election results and to investigate ballot counts. At a campaign rally earlier this month, Trump praised the Georgia State Election Board's MAGA-aligned majority.
I don't know if you've heard, but the Georgia State Election Board is in a very positive way. This is a very positive thing, Marjorie. They're on fire. They're doing a great job. Three members, Janice Johnson, Rick Jeffries, and Janelle King, three people, are all pit bulls fighting for honesty, transparency, and victory.
For more, we're joined by journalist Ari Berman, voting rights correspondent for Mother Jones, who called this a, quote, five-alarm fire for democracy in Georgia. Ari, welcome back to Democracy Now! Explain, first of all, who he's praising there and exactly what Georgia has done.
Good morning, Amy. Good morning, Juan. Thank you for having me back on the show. So Trump is praising three members of the State Board of Election in Georgia who are appointed by Republicans, by the Republican Party and the Republican-controlled Georgia legislature. And they made a series of rule changes earlier this month that are extremely concerning for democracy and voting rights. One, saying that counties must undertake a reasonable inquiry before certifying an election, and another saying that counties are entitled to what they call all election-related documentation before certifying an election. And I think the goal here is to try to make certification of an election optional instead of mandatory, which is how it's been understood for decades, not just in Georgia, but around the country. And the huge worry here, and why I said this is a five-alarm fire for democracy, is it appears that Georgia Republicans are laying the groundwork not to certify the presidential election if Kamala Harris wins. And they're doing exactly what Trump wanted them to do in 2020. Trump made Georgia the epicenter of the attempt to try to overturn the election. He asked local and state board of elections and election officials not to certify the election. They refused to do so. They followed the law. But it seems like in 2024, they're going to extraordinary lengths to try to implement the measures that failed in 2020 to try to rig the election for Trump.
And Ari, there is also intra-Republican fighting over this rule, isn't there? Could you talk about the role of Georgia Governor Kemp?
There is intra-Republican fighting, Juan, because remember, Georgia passed a sweeping voter suppression law in 2021 that made it harder to vote in a lot of different ways. One of the things that law did is it removed the Republican Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, who defended the integrity of the 2020 election and refused to find 11,780 votes, as Trump demanded, to overturn Biden's victory. That law removed Raffensperger from the state election board, so he was no longer chair or a voting member of the election board. Instead, it gave more power to the hyper gerrymandered Republican legislature to appoint a majority of board members. And so the fact that there is this Trump aligned majority on the State Board of Election in Georgia is a direct result of this voter suppression law that was passed by Republicans. That said, some Republicans seem to have regrets over what has occurred here. The Secretary of State Raffensperger has criticized these rule changes, saying he doesn't want 11th hour changes. Democrats have demanded an ethics inquiry. And in response to that ethics inquiry, Governor Kemp, a Republican, has asked the Attorney General of Georgia, another Republican, whether he has the power to remove the election board members. So this isn't playing well with establishment Republicans, because establishment Republicans were the ones who were purged from the State Board of Election in favor of this MAGA-aligned majority.
And Georgia is not the only battleground over this issue. Could you talk about what is happening in other states, specifically Michigan and Nevada?
Yeah, so we've already seen local election officials in other states, including Arizona, Michigan, Nevada, not certify local election results. We also saw that happened in Georgia, too, in the last presidential primary. And this is so concerning because these state and local election boards have been taken over in some cases by election deniers, by MAGA extremists. And what they're doing is they are trying to institutionalize the insurrection through other means. So Trump failed to overturn the election results, but in a lot of key battleground states, they didn't just change the voting laws, they also changed who's serving on these key state and local boards. And the administration of elections matters so much because you can cast a vote, you can have your vote counted, but it doesn't actually matter until votes are certified. We learned that in 2020. Nothing is final until the elections are certified. And we've already seen evidence that Republicans are preparing not to certify an election if it doesn't go their way.
Ari, you wrote a piece for Mother Jones headlined, "Tim Walz has a stellar record on voting rights." Can you talk about what that record is and how it compares, for example, with the vice presidential running mate of Trump, with J.D. Vance, who wanted to overturn the November election of 2020?
When he was governor of Minnesota, Tim Walz signed a number of really impactful bills on voting rights. He signed a Minnesota Voting Rights Act, which was meant to restore protections of the Voting Rights Act that were gutted by the Supreme Court. He passed laws making it easier to vote through things like Election Day registration, pre-registration for 16 and 17-year-olds, more early voting, restoring voting rights to 50,000 people with past felony convictions. And this is a huge contrast to the Trump's vice presidential nominee, J.D. Vance, who has basically said he would have used his power to try to overturn the 2020 election if he had been vice president, and has doubled down on election denial. So you have one vice presidential candidate in Tim Walz who has used the power of his office to try to expand voting rights. And you have another vice presidential candidate, J.D. Vance, who said he would do everything in his power to try to undermine voting rights. And that's a pretty stark contrast, particularly at a time when voting rights is emerging in Georgia and other states as a central issue in the presidential campaign.
About Arizona, Ari, what just happened there around immigrants and voting rights and the right to vote?
There was an emergency Supreme Court case that came before the Supreme Court in Arizona regarding proof of citizenship to register to vote. So having to show things like a passport or birth certificate to be able to register to vote. And the Supreme Court said that voters there have to show this documentation to be able to register to vote and to be able to vote in state elections. And this is very concerning because this is a last minute change. We're in late August right now. Arizona is a vote by mail state. So ballots get sent out soon. And there's a lot of confusion over what documents you need to register to vote. And it's thrown a lot of the state into confusion when they don't just have a competitive presidential election, but they have a competitive races for Senate, for state legislature. They have a lot of prominent ballot initiatives, including a ballot initiative on abortion. There's lots of important down ballot races over who's going to decide control of elections in places like Maricopa County, the largest county in the state. And the interesting thing is the Supreme Court has said, don't change voting laws too close to an election. Well, the Supreme Court just changed voting laws close to an election in a way that it appeared will help Republican candidates try to win the election. So it sets a very disturbing precedent both on the ground, but for also for voting rights more broadly.
Finally, Ari, you know, we just came from the Democratic convention, before that, the Republican convention, all the discussion of the battleground states, that these are the only ones that will determine what happens in November. Someone tweeted something like DEI for white states, not all white states, but these are some of the what these include some of the whitest and least populous states. Explain why these states are what determine who is president of the United States rather than the national popular vote. If you can explain the national popular vote interstate compact and where it stands now.
Well, the reason why we focus every year on 6 to 8 presidential battleground states is because of the Electoral College. And the Electoral College is fundamentally undemocratic in two different ways. First off, it creates a situation where you can win the Electoral College but lose the popular vote, which just violates basic notions of one person, one vote. But it's also undemocratic in that 80% of Americans have a vote that really doesn't matter for presidential elections because they live in states that are either too red or too blue to actually matter. And so the focus is always on these battleground states that tend to be whiter and more conservative and more Republican than the country as a whole. And whether you live in a redder state like Texas or a bluer state like New York or California, nobody comes to your state to campaign because you're not one of these carefully curated battlegrounds. So the Electoral College is both undemocratic and also not reflective of the country writ large. What the National Popular Vote Compact would do is if states that reach 270 Electoral College votes sign onto it, which is what you need to win the presidency, therefore, they will assign their state's electors to the winner of the popular vote. So it's a way, essentially, to abolish the Electoral College without having to pass a constitutional amendment, which is much tougher to do.
Ari Berman, we thank you for being with us, author of Minority Rule, The Right-Wing Attack on the Will of the People and the Fight to Resist It. He's voting rights correspondent for Mother Jones Magazine. We'll link to your recent piece, MAGA election deniers are going all out to rig Georgia for Trump. Next up, we go to Texas, where the Republican Attorney General has just led a series of raids on the homes of Latino leaders and members of LULAC, the country's oldest and largest Latino civil rights group. Stay with us.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same. And the people in the houses all went to the university where they were put in boxes and they came out all the same. And there's doctors and lawyers and business executives, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same. And they all play on the golf course and drink their martinis dry, and they all have pretty children, and the children go to school, and the children go to summer camp, and then to
Little Boxes by Malvina Reynolds. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to Texas, where the Republican Attorney General Ken Paxton is raising concerns about voter suppression by targeting the country's oldest Latino civil rights group, LULAC, the League of United Latin American Citizens. LULAC was first founded to fight discrimination against citizens of Mexican descent in Texas. Now it's responding to a series of raids of the homes of LULAC member state lawmakers and other Latino leaders in the San Antonio area last week. Speaking to the media Monday, longtime LULAC volunteer, 87-year-old Lydia Martinez, described how armed officers arrived at her home at 6 a.m. with a warrant to seize electronic devices, swab for DNA as they collected evidence of alleged vote harvesting and identity fraud.
I was in my nightgown and I thought it was my next door neighbor. And I went to the door and nine officers from the attorney general's office walked in and they had a search warrant. And they told me that they were there because I had filed a complaint that seniors were not getting their mail ballots. And I said, yes, I did. And he says, do you have the names? And I said, I have a few of the names. And they came in and I said, can I get dressed? They didn't let me. They set me down and they started searching all my house, my storeroom, my garage, my kitchen, everything. And after 2 hours of questioning, they took me outside in front of all my neighbors and all the officers around me. And for half an hour while they searched the living room where I had been sitting, and after half an hour they let me go back in the house and they continued the questioning and asking me about LULAC members in particular. And I told him, why are you all doing this? And he said, because there was fraud.
LULAC is calling on the Justice Department to investigate Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton over the raids. This comes as ProPublica and the Texas Tribune report. Paxton has also used consumer protection law more than a dozen times to investigate a range of mostly Latino-led organizations or groups who offer food and shelter to migrants and asylum seekers along the border. Paxton also tried to shut down the immigrant-led civil rights group FIEL in Houston, claiming it engaged in electioneering. But a judge recently shot down his effort. All of this comes as prosecutors agreed in March to drop securities fraud charges against Paxton himself that allowed him to avoid going to trial if he performed 100 hours of community service. This is separate from more recent corruption allegations Paxton faced that led to his impeachment trial last year, in which he was acquitted by the Republican-controlled Texas Senate. For more, we go to Houston, where we're joined by Cesar Espinosa, executive director of FIEL, which is the Spanish acronym for Families of Immigrants and Students in Struggle. And in Miami, Florida, we're joined by Juan Proaño, CEO of LULAC, the largest and oldest Latino civil rights group in the United States. Juan, let's begin with you. Explain what happened last week in Texas.
Well, good morning, Amy. Thank you for having me. As you said, you know, last Tuesday, to our knowledge, over 12 search warrants were actually presented to Latino leaders, LULAC members in San Antonio. In the case of Lydia, as you just described, eight armed officers came in. But in another case, Manuel Medina, almost 40 officers armed with AK-47s, SWAT gear, came in to his home at 6 a.m., His daughter was sleeping on the couch downstairs, thought someone was breaking into the home. He was upstairs with his wife and his other daughter as they came downstairs, and they were held interrogated for over 7 hours.
And Juan Proaño, what does this tell you about the efforts of the officials in Texas to intimidate Latino voters?
Well, I mean, you know, it's pervasive. You know, we've been obviously doing a lot of research here, and it didn't start last week. You know, this investigation on election integrity started over 2 years ago, essentially, at this point. Also referred by another Republican district attorney there with no evidence at all whatsoever. In June, we saw that they sued the Archdiocese of Rio Grande Valley, Sister Norma Pimentel, which provides migrants with services that are in this country legally. Then we saw last month with Annunciation House, which provides refugee services as well, obviously with FIEL, too. And we also saw 12 other nonprofits that effectively have gone through the same search and seizure process. At least what we've heard from the courts, that this is unconstitutional. Effectively, the tort law that he's using to essentially sue nonprofit organizations because they're 501c3 organizations and providing services to immigrants is really blatant discrimination. You know, our expectation was that he would obviously come after LULAC and sue LULAC, but certainly we were very surprised when he started to go after Latino leaders and actually LULAC members. Of those 12 that we know of, four of them are LULAC members, three of them are women in their 80s. And they were told not to talk to anyone post the search and seizure. They took their cell phones, they took their computers, they took documentations. In the case of Lydia, they took her calendar, which is essentially where she keeps all her doctor's appointments, personal contacts, information about her prescription medicine. And she had just been to the doctor the day before and had to go back in order to get that. And so she was left without any communication device at all to communicate with her family and had to literally leave her home, go to another LULAC member's house to get assistance.
So can you talk about the timing of this, Juan Proaño? For the first time in LULAC's history, established in 1929, LULAC's Adelante PAC, the Political Action Committee, endorsed Harris and Walz, endorsed Kamala Harris to be president. Do you think that there is a direct link? And explain the different parts of your organization.
Sure. And thank you, Amy, for that question. So, you know, LULAC, to your point, was founded in 1929 in Corpus Christi. It was actually founded as a 501c4 organization. That is the entity that everyone effectively knows and commonly refers to essentially as LULAC. We have over 535 councils around the country. Every single one of those councils is incorporated. They actually carry the LULAC name and seal. We have over 240,000 members in all 50 states. And we have actually those 535 councils in 33 states and 207 cities. So we are the largest Latino membership organization in the country. In addition to that, we have a 501c3, which is our LULAC National Institute. So all of the programmatic work that we do to provide programs and services to the Latino community is actually done through our 501c3. The 501c3 is actually incorporated in the District of Columbia. And then more recently, we actually established the LULAC Adelante PAC. And so it's actually a super PAC, and actually it's incorporated in District of Columbia. You know, I don't believe that it is actually connected specifically to the PAC, primarily because all of the lawsuits and essentially the pattern of lawsuits are primarily targeting nonprofit organizations, and specifically 501c3 organizations. They also only have purview over corporations that are founded in the state of Texas. So, PACSIN cannot go after the LULAC National Institute, the 501c3, or the LULAC Adelante PAC. But, you know, they obviously was very close in time. I believe the date of the endorsement was August 9th or August 10th. So less than 2 weeks ago at this point.
And Juan, I wanted to ask you about a separate matter also related to elections. On Monday, the governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, announced that the state has removed over 1 million names from the Texas voter rolls. Now, purges are common in many states, but that's a big number, and it's obviously coming so close to the election.
Yeah, I mean, look, we actually saw that. It came out about 5 o'clock. We started our advocacy campaign on Thursday night. It literally took us 2 days to get information about Lydia's case and to begin to gather all the facts relevant to this case. Really, it is his form of deflection, right? It's his effort to basically say, look, you know, we have 1 million people that are on our voter rolls that we effectively are removing. I actually went through those numbers. Over 467,000 of them essentially are deceased, right? Another 400,000 or so are effectively what they call in the suspended mode, but only 6,500 of those are actually what are classified effectively as non-citizens. So you're talking about 0.0065%, less than 1% of those are actually non-citizens, and only 1,900, which is 1/1,000th of a percent of that million, have actually any voting history at all whatsoever. But to say that there is systemic voter fraud and voter harvesting happening in the state of Texas is absolutely false.
Juan Braño, in a minute, we want to ask you about LULAC's study of Project 2025. But we want to bring in Cesar Espinosa, the executive director of FIEL, Families of Immigrants and Students in the Struggle. Cesar, can you start off by talking about what happened in your new office, your old destroyed by a hurricane, about the serving of a lawsuit against you by the attorney general, who himself is under investigation and went through an impeachment trial, now is serving community service, but he's also doing this?
Well, so we unfortunately lost our office. FIEL has been here in Houston for the last 17 years. And in the 17 years, we helped out so many Houstonians, regardless of their immigration status, recover from natural disasters. So just a few days after hurricane hit, or a day after hurricane hit, I was talking to my family about the fact that I was ready to get back out there, ready to serve our community and serve people, and help people get back on their feet. Unfortunately, though, this was not the case. We were hit by two storms. Number one, the actual physical storm of Beryl. And then second, the first day we moved in to our new building, we were served with a lawsuit by the state of Texas, which really took us off guard.
And what does this lawsuit say? What have you been sued for?
This lawsuit was stating that we were electioneering by a series of social media posts who were interpreted by the Attorney General of Texas as advocating for a certain party or certain issues. But at the end of the day, our institution and our work is based on educating the community, empowering the community, and getting community members from all walks of life to be integrated fully into U.S. society.
And the lawsuit was Harris County Judge R.K. Sandil denied Paxton's efforts. Could you talk about what the judge said?
Well, at the end of the day, the Judge Sandil declared that the Attorney General Ken Paxton did not have standing in the case, that he was going too far. And at the end of the day, the case was dismissed. But this sends really alarms all over the state of Texas to many organizations who are trying to help our community, and that they could be targeted as well.
And what kind of support have you received across Texas as a result of this attack by the Attorney General?
Well, we are really overwhelmed by the amount of community support that we've received, the amount of support online, a lot of people coming forward and saying that the Attorney General has come too far. You know, I always tell my wife never to read the comments in the articles or things like that. But I myself went in and read, and what I read and what I gathered from all the articles, all the everything that was published is the fact that people from all walks of life, from any side of the political spectrum, are feeling that this Attorney General is going way too far. And then on the heels of this, we hear about what Lulac is going through, and it's just one thing after another after another. Then they challenge the parole in place program. So there's so many things that they're doing, trying to disenfranchise, trying to disillusion Latinos from participating, that it's really like we are swimming up, swimming against the current here in the state of Texas.
So, Juan Proano, as we listen to what's happened to Cesar Espinosa, and you describe the raids on your members, including the home of an 87-year-old, 35-year volunteer of LULAC, can you talk about what you're demanding of the Justice Department, a review of these Texas raids, and how Paxton's actions fit into the changing politics and demographics of Texas?
So, you know, first and foremost, we stand in solidarity with César and Fiel. They are doing absolutely incredible work. And in regards to Lydia, not only is she 87 years old, Amy, she is a grandmother. She is a great-grandmother. Her five brothers actually served in the military. One of her brothers was killed in the Vietnam War and received the Silver Star. These are American U.S. citizens, right? And so, you know, for us, it really kind of sort of goes beyond the pale in regards to what these actions are. We have actually reached out to the Department of Justice. We've actually sent a letter requesting an investigation of these voter suppression tactics currently underway in Texas. We will continue to stand strong, and we're organizing our allies, both in the African-American and Latino community as well. We're going to stand, and we're going to fight.
And Juan Proano, could you talk also about LULAC's new report, The Battle Ahead, Latino Civil Rights versus Project 2025?
Sure. Well, and I apologize. There was one part there that I didn't answer for Amy. A little bit about the demographics. So in the last U.S. Census report put out by the Census Bureau, they reported that 12.1 million Latinos in the state of Texas for the first time. Right. And really, for some time now, Latinos actually outnumber non-Hispanic whites, which is at 12 million. OK, so when you take into account not just the Latino population in the state of Texas, but the African-American and Asian population, and even if you factored in the two races or more, the minority community in Texas now stands at over 60%. Texas is and has been a majority minority state. And so that large demographic shift that you are seeing, you know, is prevalent. And so we see these effectively as tactics for the Republicans to actually stay in control of the government in Texas. The demographics are shifting. They're not going to be able to change that anytime soon. And they are going to have to deal with that sooner than later. In regards to Project 2025, LULAC actually published a couple of weeks ago really the first and only report that I see that analyzed Project 2025 through a Latino lens. Obviously, it's been very widely reported throughout. It was obviously very prevalent in the Democratic National Convention's platform. In Chicago, we were there to listen to Vice President Harris and Walz actually speak to that. You know, I was very concerned, shocked, when I was watching the Republican National Convention on that Tuesday, and they came out with mass deportation signs. You know, somebody thought about that. Somebody designed those signs. They ordered them. They printed them. They passed them out to thousands of people in that convention center. That's only one part of what is in Project 2025. You know, they're talking about effectively, you know, programs which effectively are for unserved communities, of gutting that, the Department of Education as well, limiting different types of visas which allow for pathways for citizenship into this country. It is systemic all the way through. It would impact not only Latino communities, but other immigrant and minority communities across the country. And not just minority communities, it would impact a significant number of non-Hispanic whites because it really cuts across socioeconomic factors as well.
We want to thank you both so much for being with us. Juan Proano is CEO of LULAC. He was speaking to us from Miami, Florida. And Cesar Espinosa is executive director of FIEL in Houston, Families of Immigrants and Students in the Struggle. You can see all of our segments on the Republican and Democratic National Conventions and Immigration and Project 2025 at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
For 142 years, the Queen's Gaels have called Kingston home. The tricolor has become as